There we go. That's better. That's better. I've been talking into the light for 2.5 years. All right. My name is Denver Mund from the Institute for Global Health. I think a few medical school classes are still in session and third years are out, so not sure if people will be dribbling in later on, but we'll get started anyway. I just wanted to introduce our moderator, Carol Etherington. I think she needs no introduction. Last year's Vanderbilt Alumnus of the Year, Alumna of the Year, and former board president and 10-year board member of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, is on our faculty in our School of Nursing, and I'm proud to say is a member of our institute. So, Carol.
Well, thank you. I didn't know you were going to introduce me as I introduced this symposium.
I'm actually the slide guy.
Okay, good. Okay. Well, again, welcome. You have many places that you could be, and you're choosing to be here, and I hope at the end of this hour you'll be glad that you chose to be here this hour. I think it's a very interesting program, and it's one of the quarterly symposia, as Sten just said, that showcases global health research and partnerships such that we can sort of give some examples of the breadth of the contributions that are made by Meharry faculty and Vanderbilt faculty, and give people a better sense of how many initiatives are going on around the globe by the faculty in these two institutions, and also to give people a chance to network with one another as you meet folks who have like interests or perhaps have a like focus on a geographic area. Because the program is so quick in the way that the format runs, I want to go ahead and introduce our first speaker. And as I do that, Olivia's going to come up and make sure the it's there. Okay. So our first speaker today is Dr. Flora Ucoli, whom many of you may know, some of you may know. Dr. Ucoli has an extensive resume, as does each of our speakers today. She is a native of Nigeria. She attended the University of Ibadan. She got her doctorate of public health at the University of Glasgow in Scotland, and is a fellow of the West African College of Physicians. And in the 90s, she studied epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. A long list of publications, as you might gather, and a lot of teaching experience in different places around the globe. Most recently, she has been at Meharry as principal investigator of the Prostate Cancer Dietary Risk Study, that's at Howard University, excuse me, and she is the director of the Prostate Cancer Research Program at Meharry Medical College. So today, her topic is on that subject, and she'll be specifically talking about risk factors among men of African ancestry. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm going to try and say everything as quickly as I can so I can say it in 12 minutes. I'll first introduce the Department of Community Health at the University of Benin Teaching Hospital. They have a primary care program there, and I'll go right down to the bottom and talk about their community health programs. They usually develop, implement, and evaluate programs that have been mandated by the Federal Ministry of Health in Nigeria, or the World Health Organization, or the UNICEF. But sometimes they also run programs to meet the health needs of communities based on what we call community diagnosis process, which is carried out by our medical students. This is a program that we run annually. Medical students have to spend 8 weeks doing their urban and rural clinical postings, and we have up to 8 groups of at least 30 students every year. So my research interests have been quite varied over the years, starting with basically clinical work, but now I do epidemiology, and I am now looking at risk factors of diseases, and most especially prostate cancer. That's what I'm doing now in the rainforests of Africa. So prostate cancer, the incidence varies very widely across the world, and as you can see from this map, the places in red have the highest rates, over 100 per 100,000, and then the green portions have very low rates. And Nigeria is in the yellow portion, less than 20 per 100,000. When you compare this with the United States, the blue bars show incidence rate, and for America, it's about 5 times the rate for Nigerians, although the mortality rate for prostate cancer is slightly higher among Nigerians. And this slide just shows us comparing African Americans specifically to Nigerians. And you can see the blue bars again for incidence rate, African Americans about 10 times more likely to have prostate cancer than the Nigerians, and the mortality rate is about 3 times higher. Now, so which means African Americans have the highest incidence of prostate cancer in the world, and people have therefore thought about genetic reasons for this and have looked at Jamaicans and Caribbean people, and the rates they found there were about 42 or 52 per 100,000. Although some prevalence studies from these areas have sort of brought up figures of about 300 per 100,000, and people immediately think that is so high, but that is a prevalence rate, not incidence. So for sub-Saharan Africa, that part of the world is designated low incidence for prostate cancer. It's low, probably because of under-reporting, absence of screening, or competing mortality. But a study from DC in the 70s, it was an autopsy study, showed that latent prostate cancer rate was 3 times higher in Washington, DC, African Americans compared to Nigerians. This is just a group of African chiefs enjoying themselves. So rate in Nigeria, prevalence rate of most things, particularly prostate cancer, is estimated from hospital data. That is because we don't have cancer registers and we have limited population-based data. But we are aware that surgeons find prostate cancer by chance in almost 80% of specimens resected for enlarged prostate. And prostate cancer makes up to 10% of all surgical specimens. But the bad news is that Nigerians tend to present very late. 81% present late. 2/3 of them already with paraplegia and bone metastasis. Survival is bad, 26% dead within 6 months, and 64% dead within 2 years. Incidence for prostate cancer has been on the rise in the past few years. Prostate cancer used to be second to liver cancer, but right now is the most diagnosed cancer in adult men. The rising incidence is said to be probably due to improved case finding, longevity, or possible exposure to risk factors, which they tend to say westernized diet. The etiology of prostate cancer is basically unknown, but we do have associated factors, and genetic factors account for less than 10% of this cancer. Diet and cancer, the close link between diet and cancer has been established, but we have studies which show us that up to 10% of the white-black disparity in prostate cancer seen in America is probably due to diet. So the other causes of other factors, diet, lifestyle, age, particularly and endocrine, all add up to prostate cancer risk. This is just a group of women selling fish and chicken in the market. But you see that why I showed that picture, that chicken and the fish is actually imported. It's probably from around here also. So why am I studying this African population? The reason is because of that disparate incidence which I showed, which suggests that there are differences in type and magnitude of exposures or differences in susceptibility. We are told that Africans and African Americans have similar genetic pool, so we want to look at frequency of polymorphisms and see how these interact with the environment. And I'm thinking that if we study diverse populations, we'll be able to see a wider range of exposure measures, you know, because some people will be very low in another country and very high in another country. If you add the two together, we have a wider range. My long-term goal is to try and establish a Nigerian cohort study. So that's my long-term goal. But for this particular study, I'm trying to sustain a research partnership with the University of Benin Teaching Hospital, where I worked for 23 years. We want to be able to train the team in human subject protection and safety, how to collect quality data and samples, and how to manage their own data, enter their data, and do everything that needs to be done. Personally, I want to have a real working relationship with the local IRB, and then find how to store and ship biological samples and questionnaires between the two countries. So in this study, it's a case control design to recruit 100 prostate cancer cases and 200 controls, collect demographic and dietary information, measure their body fat, and get fasting blood sample and urine, and then later use statistical methods to calculate associations. So the participants are being recruited from the community and from the hospital in these places that I show. And my questionnaire, unfortunately, we don't have a validated food frequency questionnaire that includes African food. So we tried to modify the block questionnaire, and we had to sort of develop culturally appropriate portion size models. And the bio samples are collected in Africa, stored at minus 20 degrees until shipped on dry ice to the U.S. And I'll tell you that shipping on dry ice is not a funny story. There's only one dry ice making company in the whole of Nigeria. So far, my results is that I have up to about 800 people in the database and almost 1,000 variables. And we've had two publications and two of our five posters have been presented, and I've given three oral presentations from this work. But the summary of everything is that the hospital group and the community group are not exactly the same. They are different in age and education and things like that. They're a little bit different. But the strange thing is their obesity rate is exactly the same, but the hospital people have a larger waist-hip ratio, and we don't know why. So looking at the preliminary data so far is that odds ratio for prostate cancer risk, we calculated it for the first and fourth quartile of meat intake, and red meat and organ meat are the two things that appear to have statistically significant trend for prostate cancer risk. And then, if you look at individual fatty acids, we have three of them that are statistically higher in the cases, and only one, which is an omega-3 fatty acid, which is lower, as if it's a protective factor. And that statistics was also confirmed when we did the odds ratio calculations. And in this slide, I'm quickly just going to show you that comparing African Americans to Nigerians, every single fatty acid is statistically different, except for vaccinic acid. I don't know why. So that acid is the same in the two populations. But that is for another topic. This slide just shows us the fatty acids that are in the same direction of risk in the two populations of African Americans and Nigerians. So trans fatty acid, total saturated, are in the same direction. They appear to be like risk factors. The next three, including omega-3, are in the same direction. But when you look at omega-6 and overall fatty acids, they are saying opposite things. And this is simply because I think our sample is still small. We need to increase our sample to, you know, to validate our results. So I'll quickly just say my conclusion that the UBTH team has performed excellently, and this is because of the mutual trust and their sincere desire to see us succeed, irrespective of the very, very limited finances. Our preliminary results appear to be similar to what other people are saying, but we do have new leads. So far, nobody has recorded what we found, that behenic acid and nevonic acid and trans fatty acids appear to be risk factors for prostate cancer. So again, as I said, we need larger results. And my last slide is that for this program, we have successfully established a partnership with UBTH investigators, but we don't have junior investigators and we don't have postdocs in Nigeria. So we have to find a way of incorporating young people into the team, because some of us are not going to be there forever. A cohort study is feasible. It is feasible. And looking at the results, we have people with PSA of 14,000. We have people of PSA of 3,000, 4,000. This is extreme advanced prostate cancer. Somehow, we need to find a way of getting the Nigerians to begin to develop their prostate cancer screening policy in the hospital and in the community. And the same goes for cancer, HIV, and everything else, because it looks like we just sit down and wait for things to get very bad before we take action. And I must quickly acknowledge all the people I've been working with in the past, and currently my postdoc is here, Dr. Tahir. I had a resident doctor working on this grant previously, Dr. Mefuna is gone. And now we have Dr. Beach, the chair of the Department of Surgery, who gives all of his support. Here at Vanderbilt, I work with Jay Folk in the Department of Epidemiology. He does prostate cancer epi research, and Dr. Harvey Moff, who recently started working on fatty acids. So I'm trying to tie myself to him. So instead of sending samples to Baltimore for fatty acid analysis, we can do it right here in Vanderbilt. And in Benin, I have a large number of people who have been on this project, but for now, we only have two people because money ran out a long time ago. So right now, I just have the last two people on this project, the urologist and the general surgeon. And the communities where we have worked is shown there, and then the health centers, the teaching hospital, and the affiliated hospital. So with that, I think I nearly did it. And this is our football team. The reason why I put that man at the bottom, the smiling guy, he just looks like an African-American. I can't tell the difference. So I think we are probably exactly the same. Thank you very much. Lack of knowledge. You know, prostate cancer is silent and doesn't really do anything until it has metastasized somewhere. So people are just walking around very, very happy with themselves until they begin to have bone pain and they think it's arthritis and they think it's old age. And then finally one day they show up and somebody does a rectal and finds prostate cancer. So it's lack of knowledge and absence of screening. As I said, we really don't know, but we are thinking of dietary fat. And the traditional African diet is low in meat, very low in meat, high in carbohydrate. But now with affluence and with the importation of frozen chicken and frozen turkey parts, wings and thighs, people are beginning to eat too much meat. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it. Just what do you do? What's your occupation? A very simple one-item question, which probably will not tell us very much. But since I'm collecting information from rural and urban, I have a lot of farmers. There are a lot of farmers in this database.
Our next speaker is Lawrence Mirren. Most of us have come to know him as Larry Mirren. And he's been around here for a while, but some of you may not know some of his endeavors, and you will find them out. Coming out of Michigan, where he attended Wayne State, he's been working for the last 34 years in the field of ophthalmic imaging. He currently is an assistant professor of ophthalmology and director of the Vanderbilt Ophthalmic Imaging Center, and has been seen as a leader in this area for quite some time locally, and certainly a couple of years ago it was very timely to go global when, along with Sten Vermund, they proposed a multidisciplinary initiative to introduce this ophthalmic imaging to other areas, and specifically in Peru. So with the collaboration and under the aegis of the Center for the Americas here on the Vanderbilt campus, they began a collaboration with a university in Peru. And near and dear to our hearts at this institute is the fact that it truly is a multidisciplinary initiative, including medical sociologists, psychologists, endocrinologists, nursing educators, as well as the ophthalmic imaging specialists. So he's going to speak on that today as he gives us a closer look at this initiative in Peru. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Carol. Interestingly, Dr. Ucoli mentioned lack of education and lack of screening as two of the interesting factors associated with prostate cancer. Well, I'm here to tell you that the same thing applies when we start looking at issues associated with diabetes. I'm going to start off by showing you this number on the screen, and I want you to remember this because there will be a quiz at the end of this talk, and we'll explore a little bit about what is the meaning of 380. I wanted to start off just kind of explaining a little bit about the genesis of this program. Vanderbilt has been a leader for well over 20 years now in the field of ophthalmic imaging and the ability to look at diabetic retinopathy as recorded photographically to measure natural history and outcomes and pharmaceutical interventions and all of that sort of thing. But we shifted emphasis about 8 years ago from one in which we were involved pretty exclusively in clinical trials to a patient population-based outreach program to try and reach people in the community who had diabetes and were not typically obtaining the standard of care, which is a regular eye exam to find out whether they're at risk of having visual problems. We rolled out a telemedical program back in 2001, gradually started increasing business right here in Middle Tennessee. In 2005, we took the show on the road. We put the camera on a van and started servicing some community health centers in the far northeastern quadrant of the state. Just this last year, we were awarded a grant from the State Department of Health to extend this type of mobile or itinerant retinal screening opportunity to the more than 60 community health centers throughout the entire state. And we're finally funded in order to do that and reach the folks who are most vulnerable, the elderly and the poor, who rely on safety net for provision of care. Well, the reason that we got involved in doing this, both locally and in Peru, is to address two significant problems. One of them is that, in fact, there are many disparities associated with accessing care. Race, ethnicity, age, gender, how many dollars you have or Novo Soles in your pockets, and how far away you live from the specialty care that you require if you have diabetes. The other thing that's perhaps less well understood is that there are disparities in terms of the non-uniform quality of care, even if you get to an eye specialist. A number of years ago, there was a study that was reported in JAMA that assessed the relative capabilities of various medical practitioners to look at the retina of a person with diabetes to determine whether or not they had sight-threatening disease. And you can see that there was a fair gamut of capabilities there. So it's not just a question of if you have diabetes, go to an eye doc for an exam. The real question is, if you get to the eye doc, are you getting the kind of quality exam that will help you improve your outcomes by identifying some of these risks? So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but we've got a very rigorous methodology that we use. The clinics identify the patients. They're appointed so that when the camera shows up, they're there. We measure their actual visual acuity using a standardized target. We dilate the patient. We image them using a high-resolution digital retinal camera. We send the images over the internet in a HIPAA-compliant fashion so that there's no issues associated with losing confidential data. We go through a very rigorous process of analyzing these images to identify not just diabetic lesions, but because these are poor and elderly people who move around a lot, If we find anything else associated with potential for visual or systemic problems in the retina, those are reported as well. And the results of this analysis are then conveyed back to the primary physician along with evidence-based guidelines for appropriate follow-up care. Now, we actually use non-professional people to do the screening. Typically, we train medical assistants or nurses in the participating clinics to do it because they're a familiar face. And what we're trying to do is increase the compliance by making this a comfortable procedure in the medical home of the patient who really needs the care. So we measure with a special desktop gadget. Actually, if you've gone to the Tennessee Driver's License Bureau to get a driver's license, you know, put your head in the box and read the lines, that's essentially what we're doing here, except we've got a more quantifiable target. We pharmacologically dilate everyone for this. And while the patients are dilated, we teach them a little bit because the whole issue of compliance to care requires education. And over again, we find that patients who submit to screening know little or nothing about the implications of diabetes to their future visual health. So they're a captive audience. Let's teach them a little bit about it. And we've got various methods to do that. This is a picture of the camera that we use. It's the head unit there is about 50 pounds. It's small enough that we can strap it into a car seat and drive it anywhere that there's electricity, basically. And we do something called a hub and spoke. We basically take the camera on the road, acquire the images, bring it back to Nashville, upload it to the server, and then go through the process of analysis. We, as I mentioned, do this in a HIPAA-compliant fashion. The whole screening initiative here has got sensitivities and specificities in excess of 90%, which is almost unheard of in a screening paradigm. And we use an international system for assessing for risk factors and coming up with suggestions for follow-up care. I'll go through this real quickly. This is a normal retina. If you had a chance to look at some of our high-resolution screens, you would be amazed at how much detail can be captured this way. There is the beginnings of diabetic retinopathy, little red spots that start showing up. Lipid exudates, which are the yellowish lesions that you see on the photographs there. How about that? A little bit better? Okay. And of course, diabetic retinopathy is a progressive disorder. If we don't catch it and treat it, it gets worse and worse. This is a patient that now has had a vitreous hemorrhage because of the creation of neovascular tissue, which is extremely friable, breaks readily, and the end stage of the disease can actually lead to total blindness as the result of a traction retinal detachment. I mentioned comorbid findings. Glaucoma is one of them. Increased intraocular pressure, which shows up as changes in the configuration of the optic nerve. Because this is a process that records the optic nerve, we can identify patients whom we call glaucoma suspects and then recommend follow-up care for them. This is probably the most exciting thing in terms of adding value to this process. If you notice that little bifurcation of an arteriole there with a little bright lesion right at the fork in the road, so to speak, that's an intraarterial embolus. This is a patient who has an atheroma somewhere, for the capsule of which has ruptured. The contents are now liberated into the bloodstream. These fatty molecules and concretions are now floating around. And of course, you know what happens if one of those lands in the brain. You've got a stroke or a heart attack if it's in a coronary artery. We can pick these things up in the retina when they're asymptomatic. This little sentinel lesion that says, hello, we have got a major systemic problem here that's going on. Best get at it. And so the beauty of this, then, is that we start out trying to save a person's vision, and we have the potential for saving their life by alerting the internist that there is, in fact, a potential calamity waiting to happen here. So in 2003, this is our network. We started off with four cameras, and over time, we started taking the show on the road, and we started increasing the access to care in non-urban areas. And we built this relationship with primary care people. And this is currently what we're covering in the state of Tennessee. And then we thought, well, by golly, if we've already proved the concept here, why can't we do this anywhere? And an opportunity came up with the Center for the Americas on the university side of campus, and through the good offices of Sten Vermund, who already had relationships with a medical school in Lima called the Universidad Peruana Cayetano Heredia, we were able to create a relationship in which a camera now is located in the public hospital associated with that university, connected right here to Vanderbilt. And well, the reason why we decided to go there, besides the already existing relationships that Sten had facilitated, is that there's actually a lot of similarities between Peruvian and American healthcare. The burden is large in terms of uninsured and underinsured citizens. There is a terribly inequitable distribution of resources. Over 90% of all physicians in the country of Peru practice in Lima, which means that if you live in one of the departments far away, you're pretty much out of luck. There are the typical disparities of care that we know about here that are, again, replicated there. If you're elderly or poor or live far away, you are going to do without any kind of specialist care whatsoever. And just like in the United States, there's a hugely expanding, in more ways than one, problem with obesity and consequently with new cases of diabetes. In Peru, there's also another variable that's going on, and that is a continued in-migration of people who live in either the Amazonian regions or in the Andes, who look at Lima as this golden city on the hill, although it doesn't look too golden when it's covered in smog like this. For economic opportunity, it's a wonderful place to go, but what folks do is they exchange a physically challenging life for one in which they sit in a straw hut in the shanty town and they wait for opportunity that probably will not come. So it's hard to stop that kind of a trend from continuing, though. Patients in our program are screened at no charge. The program currently is underwritten by some seed money from the Center for the Americas. There are NGOs in Lima who have agreed to take on patients who require laser therapy for sight-threatening conditions, regardless of their ability to pay. The operational research, along with our colleagues in Peru, is to really try and figure out what is the best practice here. How can we manage a group of people with diabetes who have no place else to turn and yet clearly are in need of this kind of preventive eye care? There's lots of data out there that suggests that the problem is huge and getting bigger. As much as almost 10 years ago, in a shanty town, there was a 10% prevalence of diabetes. And of course, you know that those folks are just not getting an annual dilated retinal exam. It's just not in the cards for them. The Peruvian Endocrinology and Ophthalmic Professional Societies have just recently endorsed this program, and we've had some steadfast support from the Pan American Health Organization. What I do is kind of abstract. I sit in my office and I look at these round orange images day after day, patient after patient, looking at retinas, and you know, it would be nice to look at the faces that are attached to those retinas. So when I went to Lima this last year, I decided to take a trip up to the Pueblo Jovene, the new town, the shanty town up there. And it was kind of a sobering moment for me to see the people and the desperate conditions that they live in and recognize that this is something that really has to happen if they have a hope of maintaining visual health. Aggregate results from both Peru and Nashville, which is actually kind of the same thing in terms of the results of the screening program, about 60% normal, don't need anything, but they've been screened, which is the important thing. 30% either have glaucoma suspicion or perhaps they just don't see well enough in the States, for example, to drive. Clearly, there's a deficit that needs to be addressed. 10% of the patients that we look at have florid diabetic retinopathy that requires laser treatment, and it requires it soon. So this is a process that identifies those patients and gets them onto the provider of care. And up to 2% of all of the patients that we screen have those atheromatous lesions that represent some significant danger to them systemically. I had introduced the number 380 to you a little bit while ago. It's actually the number of people in millions in the world who have diabetes. And what's worse is that every single one of those 380 million people require a dilated retinal examination every single year. It kind of boggles the mind. So the question is, what are we going to do about it? And I think our research project, both here in Tennessee and in Peru, suggests that maybe there is an answer. Have any questions? Thank you.
Well, it is.
Can you describe for folks exactly what laser surgery entails? In other words, is there any hope that non-ophthalmologists will ever practice laser surgery? Because that is one of the rate limiting steps, is the availability of intervention.
Yeah. Well, laser surgery is essentially taking a microscope that has a laser attached to it, and essentially cauterizing defective blood vessels that have been damaged by diabetes, you know, because hyperglycemia is essentially toxic to blood vessels everywhere in the body, but especially in the retina because of the small caliber. So if we can identify the patients for whom that damage has already been sustained, we can staunch the progress of it by applying this very carefully applied laser beam that cauterizes and seals up the damaged blood vessels so that they can't further leak fluid into the retina and cause some problems. Eventually, Stan, that would be a lovely thought to train non-professional people, if you will, to do this. But I would expect that there's certain turf battles on the horizon in terms of the scope of practice and things of that sort, where physicians who've spent many years perfecting their technique probably don't want to be upstaged by someone off the street who's been given a crash course in laser surgery.
And it may be dangerous.
It may be. One mistake. By the way, laser is a destructive therapeutic regimen. The cautery is it actually damages and creates a scar in the retina. You can imagine if the lesion is close to the visual center of the eye and a mistake is made, and now that burning ray of the laser is applied right into the center of the visual process and causes permanent damage. So there's some little things out there that you have to be aware of.
But given how quickly this project has evolved into being a global one from Little Vine Hill Clinic just within the last 10 years, and I think I'm correct, one of the primary first sites was in a nurse-managed clinic.
Absolutely.
In Vine Hill. So it really has gone very far, very quickly, and it's quite something. So we'll switch gears again and introduce you to Dr. Timothy Sterling, who will be speaking on risk factors for TB. Came from Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, did his residency training in internal medicine at Columbia Pres. And after serving 4 years with the Army, he received a fellowship in infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins, joined the faculty there in 1998, and also served as director of the Baltimore City Health Department Tuberculosis Clinic. In 2003, Vanderbilt got him, and we were very happy about that. He is director of epidemiology research, and he also serves as the director of the epidemiology and outcomes unit of the Vanderbilt Meharry Center for AIDS Research, as well as the director of tuberculosis research at the Nashville Metropolitan Health Department. So with numerous interests focused on epidemiology and the treatment of TB and HIV, I think today you're going to focus primarily on work in Brazil. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So it's going to take me a while to get to the Brazilian component of this, but please bear with me. And I also have way too many slides. This is going to be a little quick. These are data from the WHO that were released 2 weeks ago, and they're the estimates of TB notification rates for 2006. In the U.S., we had about 13 or 14,000 cases. You can see in South America that Peru has high rates, but Brazil actually has the greatest number of TB cases, so a very high burden. And to set the stage in regards to TB transmission and pathogenesis, you see here transmission of TB from an adult to a child. And if infected, there'll be a skin test conversion in about 6 to 8 weeks. Now, in most patients, there'll be spontaneous healing. And this represents 90% of infected persons. The infection will be walled off and contained. In about 10%, they progress to active disease. 5% will do so within 2 years, and 5% will do so later in life. And this is the issue. Why do 10% progress to active disease? What distinguishes them from the 90% who do not? Then also by way of background, pulmonary disease in adults represents most of the TB burden, 75 to 80%. It's generally reactivation disease. It affects the upper lobes and is cavitary. When it's primary disease, it affects the lower lobes. In children, they're more likely to get progressive primary disease, and there's not a whole lot of TB bacilli involved. It's often culture negative and difficult to distinguish between primary infection and active disease. Extrapulmonary disease is defined as TB outside of the pulmonary parenchyma and can affect several sites in the body. There are several factors that influence TB risk. There are several at the population level, poverty, overcrowding, immigration, but then also several factors at the individual level, time since infection, dose of infection, age and sex, several underlying diseases, particularly pulmonary silicosis, HIV infection is the greatest risk factor, malnutrition, injection drug use, smoking is a risk for pulmonary disease. But in addition to all of this, there has also been literature suggesting that there's a genetic predisposition to tuberculosis, and this presumably correlates to an immunodeficiency. There are several risk factors for extrapulmonary disease. The key among them is HIV infection. Up to 80% of HIV-infected persons will have extrapulmonary disease, compared to 10 to 20% of HIV-negative persons, and the risk increases as the CD4 count declines. Young children are at risk for extrapulmonary disease, particularly when they're less than 5 years of age. Women and persons of black race also appear to be at increased risk of extrapulmonary disease. These epidemiologic findings suggest that if there's an immunologic defect that predisposes to TB, you would most likely be able to identify it in persons with extrapulmonary disease. Now, I don't have enough time to go through this in detail, and I apologize. This is a schematic of the host immune response to MTB infection. But just pay attention to this. The key is the interaction between MTB and the macrophage, and that unleashes a cascade of cytokines and chemokines to help, it's the human host immune response to control infection. And so key among those are underlined in red, interferon gamma, interleukin 12, MCP1. For this talk, if you just pay attention to interferon gamma and MCP1, you'll be in good shape. And then one other schematic, the importance of the interaction between MTB and the macrophage. And the thing I want you to pay attention to here is toll-like receptor 2. So this, in conjunction with CD14, is important for TB to be recognized by the macrophage and then taken up into the cell. When you're trying to design a study to assess factors that predispose to disseminated TB, there are some things you need to keep in mind. Disseminated mycobacterial infections in HIV-negative children have been associated with decreased interferon gamma production. HIV infection is the most profound immunosuppressant, so you'd really like to take that out of the picture and therefore look just at HIV-negative persons. Active TB affects cytokine responses, so you're really best if you look at persons who are not acutely ill. And this has been our approach to identifying genetic factors that predispose to TB. We'd like to look at polymorphisms that have an immunologic correlate. A lot of studies have been quite large and have found genetic polymorphisms associated with TB risk, but the functional correlate is unknown. So we have tried to look for immunologic defects first, then focus on genetic polymorphisms. And this summarizes a study done in adults in the United States, HIV negative adults. There were 10 with extrapulmonary disease, 24 with pulmonary, and 30 who were tuberculin skin test positive. So they had MTB infection, but did not have evidence of active disease. And one of the key points here is the median CD4 count was lower in persons who had prior extrapulmonary disease than those who had pulmonary disease or were skin test positive. So again, this is among HIV negative persons. The other interesting finding was that unstimulated cytokine production of the peripheral blood mononuclear cells was uniformly low in persons who had had previous extrapulmonary disease. It didn't always achieve statistical significance, but you can see with each of these cytokines and chemokines that it was uniformly low in persons who had prior extrapulmonary disease. We then tried to identify genetic polymorphisms associated with these defects. So we combined two study populations, again in the U.S., 24 extrapulmonary cases, 24 pulmonary controls, and 57 PPD-positive controls. We took three different approaches to look for genetic associations. One was using just SNPs and microsatellites that had previously been associated with TB. One was to look at SNPs in genes that were associated with TB pathogenesis. And then the third was to use a genome-wide SNP chip with over 50,000 SNPs. And what we found was that the TOL2 microsatellite predicted had 62% prediction accuracy among all patients and had 76% prediction accuracy for extrapulmonary TB in blacks, and this was statistically significant. We did not find SNPs when we looked at those that were associated with TB pathogenesis, and when we did the genome-wide assessment, we did find one SNP that was associated with extrapulmonary TB in blacks, but the functional significance of this is unclear. So this appears to be the most important and is interesting in the context of the low CD4 count and the low cytokine production. So TB meningitis is a devastating manifestation of TB. It's the most severe form of extrapulmonary disease, and children, particularly those under age 5, are particularly prone to get it. But it's unclear why. It's always been hypothesized, well, it's an immature immune system, but nothing more than that is known. So this is the study we conducted in Brazil, a case control study in Rio de Janeiro. We enrolled 18 children with prior miliary meningeal disease, 28 pulmonary TB controls, and 29 PPD positive controls. They had culture confirmed disease or clinical criteria for meningeal, and they had all completed therapy. So we had several conditions assessing the peripheral blood mononuclear cells, and then we looked at several important cytokines that are known to play a role in TB pathogenesis. Now, if you remember, in adults, we found a low CD4 count in those with extrapulmonary disease. In the children, we did not. So the median CD4 count, there was actually no difference. If anything, it appeared to be slightly higher in those with miliary meningeal disease. There was no cytokine defect identified in miliary meningeal cases compared to either set of controls, no defect in interferon gamma or TNF-alpha. Of the 9 cytokines measured, only MCP1 was significantly different in cases and controls. And you can see here that uniformly, regardless of the condition, these are all the stimuli that were used, including the resting condition, that MCP1 levels were higher among children with prior pulmonary TB. The role of MCP1 in pulmonary TB has been studied in adults with active disease. There's a study in Pakistan that found that adults with pulmonary disease had increased MCP1 levels. And interestingly, in a study from with patients from both Mexico and Korea, there was a single nucleotide polymorphism in the MCP1 promoter that was associated with pulmonary TB. And that SNP was also associated with increased MCP1 levels. So our findings are actually consistent with what had been shown previously in adults. But when we then looked for the G allele, we did not find that to be increased among children with pulmonary TB compared to those with miliary meningeal or PPD positive. So we found the same immunologic finding, but not the genetics. This clearly was an underpowered study, but the proportion of children with this G allele was in the opposite direction of what was seen in adults. So there are some key findings and differences in our studies of extrapulmonary TB. In adults, they had a low CD4 count, low unstimulated cytokine production. There was a global cytokine defect, not a specific defect, and the Toll receptor 2 microsatellite had high predictive accuracy for extrapulmonary disease. In contrast, in young children, they had normal CD4 counts, normal unstimulated cytokine production, no cytokine defect associated with miliary meningeal disease, uniformly higher MCP1 levels, but it was not associated with the polymorphism in the promoter. So TB risk is clearly multifactorial, as I said at the beginning. Pulmonary and extrapulmonary TB may have different pathogenesis. Childhood and adult TB may be two distinct entities, and therefore the immunogenetic factors that predispose to TB likely vary according to patient age and site of disease. And this has implications for studying and then subsequently targeting populations for TB prevention. Our next steps include the following. First is a large-scale immunogenetic study to use this with the sample size that we really require. We'd like to do it in both Brazil and the United States to further clarify and confirm the immunogenetic predisposition to TB, looking at these different groups, and then functional polymorphisms associated with TB. If we find one polymorphisms in two distinct populations, it's our impression that this would improve the generalizability to other populations. Spiro Kalams and Lakshmi and Chris Fisk are working on a new model to further clarify the immune defects. This involves macrophages infected with MTB rather than just studying PBMCs alone. And then with the larger sample, we'll be able to control for confounding variables and also assess for differences according to MTB strain. So I'd like to thank the people who have funded the work and several people who have participated. Thank you. And I think I've got about 3 seconds for questions.
We don't know if
the cytokine effects several years after TB treatment reflect what was present before someone developed TB in the first place, and that's clearly a limitation.
I may have missed that. The cytokine measurements were several years post-treatment.
Everyone had completed therapy.
So we expect a return to baseline.
That's what we're hoping, but we haven't proven it. But there's a long list of studies that have looked at cytokine responses during therapy, and you know they're up or down when they're acutely ill, and then they resolve when they recover. So we're making the assumption that this represents defects that preceded the development of TB. That may not be correct. But.
Our next speaker is Dr. Spiros Kalams, who has been at Vanderbilt since the first early part of the century. Strange way to put it, but it truly is. Yeah. Dr. Kalams received his medical degree from the University of Connecticut and did his internship and residency at Beth Israel. He remained in Massachusetts for a period of time, but as I mentioned, came to Vanderbilt in 2002 as assistant professor of microbiology and immunology, and is currently an associate professor of medicine. Has more than 60 publications in peer-reviewed journals on his area of research. He has been honored by numerous associations and institutes, including the Glaser Foundation, the Pediatric AIDS Foundation, NIH, Harvard, and he has continued to served on the faculty of Harvard as well as Vanderbilt, and today with all of the various ongoing research projects he has, he's going to speak to us on technical challenges, and I'll let you read the rest of that. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and that's one thing. Since coming to Vanderbilt, I did go in directions that I never otherwise would have gone, so I never didn't dream of going into tuberculosis research, but I've got a couple collaborations now with Tim and as well with Doug Kernodle, and here's another example of something that just never would have happened had I not come to Vanderbilt. So I'll try to summarize our efforts to try to make some kind of device that we think will be economical and suitable for application in our clinics in the United States as well as third world countries. And I'll try to tell you what our progress is. And there's a pointer, and let's see. As far as advancing slides, keyboard, and that is down here. Okay, very good. All right. So I don't have a whole lot of background. I'm going to give credit for some level of knowledge, but I'm happy to answer any questions. But we wanted to make a flow cytometer or some device, basically, that can count CD4 T cells. I'm not going to go into all the details of why CD4 T cells are important, but we know that that's an important marker to evaluate in HIV-positive individuals. And currently, I'm going to go over our goals and what the current technology is, and I'll tell you what our progress is. Instead of that, this is the first time I've presented any kind of talk on this topic, so bear with me. But this is a great opportunity to summarize our work. So we want to make something that's small, and the reason, I'm guessing shoebox size, we have no idea how big, but we know that we want to be able to carry it. And the reason I think this is important is when I did visit Gesquio in Haiti, and we had a collaboration there, they have a pretty good clinic. They have a Colder counter. They have a fax scan. They can do CD4 counts. But I was struck by how difficult it was to get a similar unit to a clinic in Conj, where Paul Farmer works. They actually had to use Aristide's personal helicopter to lift the unit and bring it there because it's only 40 miles away from Gesquio, but it never would have survived the trip if they just stuck it into a Jeep and carted it up to the clinic. So we wanted something that would be relatively compact. We'd like it to run on batteries instead of plugging in because a lot of power interruptions happens all the time. One of the things that for simplicity, no need for pumps. If you look at a typical device where you're running cells through to count T cells or lymphocytes, there's always a pump involved, there's sheath fluid, it makes for more complexity, so we wanted to try to avoid that. Obviously, we want something to be accurate, and we want to be able to have some kind of high throughput. We're nowhere near being able to test these two things right now. So let me summarize. And what are the challenges of counting T cells? And I've got a couple slides to show you how we currently count T cells. Current devices detect fluorescence. We incubate cells with an antibody, and then we illuminate those cells with a laser. And then we measure the photons that come back. So we have to pick up those photons. And the current technology that we use uses photomultiplier tubes, which are very, very sensitive devices. They can image and detect a single photon coming off of a cell. But they're big. And we had a challenge to try to shrink these down. Our detectors are smaller, and they're not nearly as precise. So these are just one of the challenges that we have to deal with. Throughput, we need to get enough cells past these detectors so we can count enough to get an accurate measurement. And also power requirements. I mean, if we're going to, we got to be careful. We can't use, megawatt lasers or anything. This is something that's going to run on batteries. So we need a very high efficiency instrument. And the other thing I learned about this kind of engineering feat is that the analogy is just because you can drive a car doesn't mean you can build one. So this is what's really great about working with the Department of Engineering here, and I can't give enough credit to Dongxing Li, because this was an example of he was recruited from Canada to work in the Department of Bioengineering basically knocked on my door and says, do you have any need to maybe make something small that could be analyze something that might be useful for HIV patients? I said, and he had no concept. I said, well, yeah, I have some ideas. So this is how this all started. So this is what we typically do, and it's kind of interesting that we're sticking, this is the current technology. This is what everybody uses when you send off a blood sample to what we call Roche or wherever your whatever diagnostic laboratory. It's called a dual platform technology. So you're going to count, you need to get a count of absolute lymphocytes on a traditional Coulter counter. And that's the only way you're going to be able to get an absolute CD4 count. So you have to get the absolute number of white cells and lymphocytes. Then there's a separate tube that's analyzed by a flow cytometer, which measures the CD4 as a percentage of the lymphocytes. And I'm going to go over the gates there. And you have to multiply these two numbers to get the absolute count. And that's what we do right now. That is the standard. And this is what is happening in the flow cytometer part right here. What we measure, what they typically measure is one stain is called CD45, which is on all white blood cells in somebody's sample. And what's gated right here is this is called side scatter. This is how much light comes off sideways from the cells, and it's a measure of how granular cells are. And different cells have different levels of granularity. So this is on the y-axis. And on the x, what you can see is these are all the white blood cells. And you can see that they kind of segregate as to how granular they are. And what these are lymphocytes right here. And these are white blood. These are neutrophils. They're very granular cells up here. And this is a lot of junk. This is red cells, platelets, all this stuff over here. So we gate this out. And then they take a look at these. And you tell the computer to just look at these populations right here, and now you look at them a different way, and you put side scatter still on the y-axis, and you look at CD4 cells. So here, these are all lymphocytes right here. These are the CD4 positive lymphocytes. You take this number divided by the total number of lymphocytes. That's the lymphocyte percentage. You multiply that by the number of lymphocytes by the Coulter counter. That's how you get an absolute T-cell count. So one of our first hurdles was how do we move the cells around? We don't want to use pumps, right? So how do we do this? Well, I'm not going to go into all the physics because I barely understand it. But basically, with an electrical field, you get the water ions moving one way and the cells move the other way in the field. And these were our first attempts. We just wanted to get the flow. And this is just a cool picture. They make these little chips in the Department of Engineering. I don't know how he does it. He programs it and pours in the plastic. And these are all manufactured right on site. And the cells go over this little hurdle, and they tend to hug this hurdle. And what this does, they build up a charge here, and the big cells swing up to this way, and the little cells kind of go right over here. So this was just our first attempt, just to get familiar with flowing cells through these little capillaries. And then we just were, Dong Xing was just playing with different ways of getting the hurdles to work and make it more efficient. And this was just our first publication. We just wanted to show that without using any kind of pumps, we could send the cells through and get them past a detector. And before this work, all of this work, any kind of similar stuff had only worked with polystyrene beads. So this is an example where the engineers and the physicians aren't always communicating with each other, because it's really cool to get polystyrene beads to move in a nice straight line, but using fixed cells that have been stained. And these are cells that we gave him that were directly lysed from blood without any kind of processing, because I also don't want it to be too complicated. I don't want any separation steps. And we've done just a couple. And so this is our current setup. This is how we count the cells. And these are these little chips that are no bigger than that. And these are completely disposable, probably cost less than $1 a piece. So if your cells get clogged or don't want to go through, you can just throw it away. Right now we use this, we have one technology for actually counting the cells past the detector, and then we use a little amplifier to detect fluorescence. The laser illuminates the cell. Whatever the fluorescence comes out is counted. And this is our next project, where on the top, these are the cells that are going past the detector, and we're counting the number of cells, and then in a separate detector, we're counting the fluorescence, and there's a nice one-to-one correspondence between stained cells and what we can count. And then what we did was a very simple experiment where we just labeled half of the, we took some cells, we labeled half of them, mixed them together. We counted the ratio of stained to unstained cells on a flow cytometer on the bottom. We ran these cells through the device that we have in the lab right now. What you can see is we count all of the cells, but we only see fluorescence on half of the cells. And this was just several runs of the experiment. So basically, there's a nice concordance, at least with the number of stained cells that we can detect. And we just recently published this work as well. And the reason that this was gratifying to me is that we tried to submit this as a grant before we have our current CFAR funding, and we got killed with that section. They said, you know, there's no way you get a photodiode, you won't be able to detect fluorescence, people have tried it. And in fact, this was looking at the study section of some very prominent flow cytometry experts and telling us that this couldn't be done. And honestly, we didn't show the data that said that we could do this. And it just goes to show you that once you get to be an expert, you think something can't be done, you think nobody else can do it. And so this is definitely feasible. So our current limitations in this is that our throughput is very slow. This, when we send cells through a flow cytometer, we get several thousand per second. This is not meant to count thousands and thousands of cells. This is meant to just count enough to get an accurate number. How many cells we need to count and for how long, that's what we have to test with our next generation of instrument. So far, even though we can detect the fluorochrome, it has to be very bright. And right now, we're limited to single color detection. And we're going to work on all of these things. And this is our plan set up right here. And what we really want to do is get a system to work with at least three different colors. And we're going to use this new technology called quantum dots that fluoresce at very specific wavelengths, and they don't overlap. That minimizes the amount of computer gyrations we need to actually separate the signal from the noise. And these are just these little particles, and depending how big they are, that's the color they fluoresce in. And so these are just little quantum dots in individual vials. This is a real off-the-shelf stuff where somebody just puts a light underneath them, and these colors don't overlap. So we can say, well, the red is a CD4 cell, that's a CD8 cell, that's a monocyte. And it's nice because they don't overlap, doesn't require a lot of computer stuff to do. The disadvantage is it's new technology, so the reagents can be somewhat expensive. But even so, I think the price we hope would come down for third world countries. And this is the last couple slides. This has worked. We've been able to get some detection with these Q dots, and we're going to be, this is all part of a CFAR developmental award where we're going to the next steps. And these are all the people that have been, Jay's a tech in the lab, she's stained all the cells, and Louise has helped us with all of the compensations and the technique. Mark, Fritz is I don't know if he's in the audience, but there it is. Mark has been interested in this work, and he's a medical student who's also interested in the bioengineering aspects and third world applications of this. So he's hot on this project to try to get this to work. And our colleagues in the Department of Engineering, Chani Chan and Dong Chi, and this is all supported by Vanderbilt and our developmental core board. So.
Something that we think is going to be a prototype, that I think we've got to make those kind of connections. We don't tend to be good at that kind of thing. I'm not good at that.
Thank you so much. Well, rounding out our speaking group is Dr. Kathy McGowan, who came to Nashville last century. Actually came from Kansas, who's going to the Final Four. Kathy actually is medical director, has been the medical director in the late 90s for the Robertson County Comprehensive Care Center. And since 2001, she's been the research director for the Comprehensive Care Center here in Nashville. And for those of you in Nashville, you know that's been sort of the lifeline for this community for many of the HIV/AIDS patients. Kathy, like her predecessors that I've introduced today, has numerous peer-reviewed articles in her area. She has been recognized with honors and awards. And she will be talking with us today about, of all the things that you might say about Nashville, you're going to be talking about the Caribbean and Latin America. Welcome.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak about CASANET. And I'll say that this is a very low-tech talk. You'll hear me say quantum once, and that's right now. It's a sort of a broad strokes. I really wasn't quite certain about who the audience was going to be, and so I've kept this very broad to give you a description of how an international collaboration has come about. Get the keyboard. I told you it was going to be low tech. Okay. So IDEA is the International Epidemiologic Databases to Evaluate AIDS. And this was NIH's big idea. It was an RFA that was sent out in February of 2005. And the notion was to establish regional centers internationally to advanced methodology for the collection and harmonization of data, and to address research questions in HIV and AIDS that could not be answered by smaller or individual cohorts, and to increase the generalizability of study results through the use of data from these different settings and populations, and to allow these regions themselves to more effectively define and monitor the epidemic. So the world was carved up into 12 regions that you can see here. On various bases. And in the summer of 2005, we put together here at Vanderbilt the pieces for a grant. And just like Dr. Callum's pointed out, I think it shows the advantage of being at a place like Vanderbilt where collaborations like this can actually happen and be successful. It was the friend of a friend approach to building the proposal. Dan Macy's, who had just recently arrived as the chair of bioinformatics, is the principal investigator, and he was obviously key in getting this together, as was Sten Vermoen, who had very recently come to Vanderbilt as well. Several people in our division and in the pediatric ID division had some experience in Haiti, and knew Bill Popp, who's our collaborator there. Brian Shepard had come here to the biostatistics department from UW-Seattle and was very interested in HIV outcomes. And then Mauro Schechter from Brazil was able to rally some of his colleagues from Argentina and Chile. And the winning application was done all through emails, really. We didn't have a single conference call and no face-to-face meetings with any of our international collaborators. I think we probably only had one here, maybe two here at Vanderbilt. So it was an interesting process. So the regions that were funded are shown here. There's four in Africa, one in Australia and Asia, one in North America, and then CASANET, Latin America and Caribbean, that I'll be talking about. I do want to mention that Tim Sterling is actually one of the site PIs for the North America cohort and is also involved in our CASANET South America cohort. And he actually contributes data from our patients here at Vanderbilt and the CCC to the North America NACORD. So this just shows you a map detail of our 7 sites now. We actually just added Mexico in the last year. They were not part of the initial application. There was only 6 countries initially. We have Port-au-Prince, Haiti, where the highest seroprevalence for HIV is, and Chile is probably the lowest. The region represents 550 million people, 8.5% of the world's population, and about 5% of the world's HIV cases. So this just shows you who our site PIs are in the various countries and their affiliations. The clinical experience of these site PIs is extensive. Almost all of them have been taking care of HIV patients since the beginning of the epidemic in their own communities for the most part. And several also have been deeply engaged in research, either operational or basic research or clinical research. Bill Pop in Haiti, of course, is a good example of a group that had been doing research for 25 years. But then some of our sites have never engaged in any research, and so we have a broad range of experience. So this is a shot as you fly into Port-au-Prince. This is probably one of the worst slums in the world, Cité Soleil. And the clinic is in a neighborhood much like this slum. And this is just to remind everyone that Haiti can be very beautiful, too. I don't think everyone thinks about this side of Haiti when they hear about it. This is our collaborator, Bill Pop, crossing the street in front of the Gueskio Centers in downtown Port-au-Prince. And this is a model of their new HIV clinic and research facility that is out near the airport, that when I saw this little model sitting there 5 years ago, I thought, they're dreaming. They're never going to build this. And, of course, they built the wall first, because that's how you start anything. But this is actually fully operational now. They're still doing some building, but they actually are treating and testing thousands of patients here and doing a lot of their clinical research right on site there. This is Marcella Wolf at outside the clinic in Santiago, Chile with Dan Macy's. And this is just a reminder of this has been a very cultural experience for us. We arrived hours before Pinochet died in Chile in December of 06, and our hotel was in the midst of the action when demonstrations got a little lively. So that was very interesting. This is the clinic in Lima, the Tropical Medicine Institute with Eduardo Gattuso. And we also got caught up in some demonstrations. These were very peaceful worker demonstrations there as soon as we left Chile, so it was a very interesting trip. And this is our Brazil colleague, Mauro Schechter, shown here. And I point out Stephanie Duda, who's sitting in the back there, who's out front, who's been very involved in the project. So what science have we accomplished with CASANET? So we've had initial site visits completed for all 7 sites. We've had first 2 papers published. Stephanie published one on an enhanced data dictionary for pooling of international multilingual data. I contributed to a cohort description of the region. We extended our funding. We had PEPFAR funding for a $100,000 supplement was received for the Haiti site for adolescent studies. And then we had an NCI institute that funding supplement about $40,000 per site to examine cancer incidence, treatment, and other outcomes in HIV-infected people in the area. So we have had our first call for data for our first 2 projects, and this just shows the cohorts on first heart therapy, which is who we wanted to look at by country. And we have a total of 5,278 patients currently in our cohort in our database. The data analysis has been completed for 5 sites for 2 projects, and our 2 projects are to look at mortality in the first year after initiating heart, and the time to and reasons for change of first heart. The analysis is in progress for 2 sites, our recently added Mexico site and then Honduras, who was also sort of late to be added for a variety of reasons. But they have submitted data sets, and they're going to be included in both of these first 2 projects. And we submitted abstracts to the IAS meeting. In terms of other work we've been doing, we've been performing GCP-based data audits on site. We've completed 5 sites and have a remaining 2 sites to go this month, and then 1 site that actually needs to be re-audited. This has allowed the Data Coordinating Center here at Vanderbilt to determine structure, quality, and reliability of the submitted data and has been a very informative process, and has allowed the local sites to identify sources of error in their data collection, abstraction, and representation. So sort of seeing the day in the life of a data element, how it gets from the patient chart to our database here at the coordinating center. And this has allowed us to make recommendations for enhancements to the site's data management and clinical care programs. The other thing we've done is begin the development of a cancer database. We have a bilingual Spanish-English case report form for malignancy data abstraction that we developed. This was field tested by one of our VUMC emphasis program students and the local team in Argentina last summer. And now, with Stephanie's help, we have a bilingual REDCap database designed for web-based entry of the cancer data. And the Argentine team is already using this, and I think our Chile site will be next. And in terms of future work within CASINET, Tim is going to be spearheading some studies looking at incidence of TB after first heart start and recurrence of TB in a prospective fashion. We are interested in looking at factors associated with loss to follow-up, which is a big problem in cohorts like these. We would like to look at the prevalence of HPV-related dysplasia in the cohort in the region and the effect of heart on this. And then Bill Pop and his group in Haiti are very interested in adolescent studies, and they'd like to extend and compare some of the things that they found in Port-au-Prince with our other sites, including high-risk behaviors, adherence issues, and antiretroviral failure. And then Brian Shepard in the biostats department very much would like to develop some novel methods looking at a lot of these issues. So this is our newly added team in Honduras in the front row. The gentleman to the second from the right is Dennis Padgett, our PI. This is downtown Tegucigalpa. And this is Juan Sierra in Mexico City, our recently added site there. And this is just a tiny little slice of Mexico City from the air that you can see through the smog. And then this is our whole group last year at our PI meeting in Buenos Aires. Pedro Kahn, who's the PI there, is right here in the blue shirt. And Eduardo Gutuzo, who I had not shown, from Lima, Peru, is standing in the back. So that's the team. And that's it. Thank you. Plans right now are that that certainly, and Stephanie might want to speak to this, we certainly can have translations in those languages as well. I think because overwhelmingly 5 out of 7 sites are Spanish speaking, that's why we've defaulted to that as the first. I must say the English speaking level and comprehension of all of our colleagues is very good, and a lot of them are more comfortable doing this work in English, which is interesting. So I don't know. We haven't had any requests yet to translate into Portuguese or French. But you're right. We're not just a Spanish-speaking cohort.
The fact you submitted abstracts for Mexico City means that you have enough data for your 5 countries that you've actually got a comparative analysis of heart.
Yeah, and we do have. Like I said, I chose broad strokes here. We do have some comparative analyses in the looking at the mortality after the first year of heart therapy. I mean, there are many site differences, some of which we like to do a little bit more sleuthing to try to figure out why. There are differences in loss to follow-up, which often obviously affects mortality when you look at that. And all of our sites are trying to be very proactive now in tracking patients and loss to follow-up. And Brian's very interested in maybe developing some statistical ways of handling that. In terms of looking at the ARV change after first heart therapy, there's actually some really interesting differences between sites. Why regimens were changed, for what reason, and how frequently. And we actually need to go back and do some more analyses to get some more data into the data set. But that may actually, a lot of those may be programmatic differences, which I wanted to point out, that having such a wide spread of different capacities, both clinical and research, and very different ways of providing ARVs, generic versus brand, and different models of care, that some of these differences may end up being programmatic, and we'll be able to look at that as well.
Yes.
There are. Each country obviously has their own guidelines. There is a huge difference. I mean, several sites, that they have a short list because they really don't have a lot of options. And almost, probably three or four of our sites, almost all exclusively two nukes and a non-nuke to start with. But a few other sites, you know, the first heart regimens, there may have been 60 of them in the database. For one site, another maybe 30 different ones, and another site maybe three. So there's huge variation across sites. So another interesting factor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One request that if you did not sign in, please do so. And those sign-in sheets are in the back. One announcement that some of you may already know about. Actually, Kathy's talk sort of moves us into a whole different area of HIV/AIDS, but there is, in the foreign film series, a film tonight sponsored by, hosted by the Global Institute of Health, and it is Night Stop. I'm going to just read you this very poignant sentence that describes it. This dark documentary depicts a night in the life of the truckers who travel the roads and the women who make their lives, who make their living from them. And this is about several very specific roads in Mozambique and the plight of the working women who live on the edge because of the prostitution. That's at Surat at 7 o'clock, so that's another face of this whole issue, and a very different face, but I think one very provocative, and Alfredo Vergara will be there as host. So if any of you are able to go to Surat tonight, I think it's a 52-minute film and it'll be quite worth your while. So as we close down, two thank yous. One, certainly to the speakers on behalf of the Institute for the information you shared with us, which is pretty amazing in terms of the amount of time that each of you had, and you filled it very well. So thank you for doing that. And the other thank you on behalf of the Institute is to each of you for being here. We hope you come to the next symposium.